Welcome to Fixated, the Fixed Income Podcast. I'm your host, Elizabeth Moran, Editorial Director of Fixed Income News Australia. Join me as I talk about the latest news, views and education in fixed income investment. I'll be joined by industry experts from Australia and across the globe. Welcome. Today I have Lauren Ryan, who is the Business Development Manager of Private Investments from Think Tank. Welcome, Lauren. How are you today?
Thanks, Liz. I'm good. How are you? Thanks for having me.
Delighted to have you. Just by the way, I've known Think Tank for many years on the investment circuit and spoken alongside Lauren and listened to Lauren. So you're in for a real treat today. So, Lauren, we're going to talk about asset-backed securities today. So asset-backed securities, or ABS, include residential mortgage-backed securities, called RMBS for short. They actually make very good investments for income-seeking investors. Can you tell me about what are their best features?
Yeah, absolutely. In our experience, investors in ABS transactions, which include RMBS, residential mortgage-backed securities, and CMBS, commercial mortgage-backed securities, these investors can gain exposure to quite a large diversified pool of loans secured by the asset of their choice. So RMBS is generally very specific to residential mortgages, commercial very specific to commercial mortgages, and ABS you have a slightly broader range with, say, credit card receivables or invoice financing or car lending or equipment lending or think assets like that. So investors are able to gain exposure to that diversified pool where the underlying asset, they can in some ways pick and choose the broad category. And as you mentioned, Think Tank offers RMBS and CMBS transactions where investors are exposed to that large diversified pool of mortgages where the underlying security property is a domestic small ticket commercial or residential property, existing property. And gaining this exposure directly can be very challenging and expensive for investors individually. So these style of structures are quite attractive. And investors in these transactions generally are seeking a regular income stream, which is derived from the underlying pool of mortgages. So the borrowers pay their mortgages, that money gets aggregated monthly, generally distributed to investors on that that periodic time frame. And generally, these transactions aren't available direct to retail investors, so it can be quite difficult to access individually.
So you get this lovely monthly income, which is exactly what many retirees or income investors are seeking. Also, you're actually exposed to a very diverse pool of loans, aren't you? How many loans would investors be looking at in a standard transaction?
It does depend on the transaction. With Think Tank's transactions, they sort of range between 700 and 1,000 loans per transaction. It does depend on the size. So with Think Tank, our average loan size is about 650. If we do a 500 mil RMBS or CMBS, you're sort of running at around the 700 loans, give or take. And in the circumstances where those transactions get upsized to, say, 750 mil, you're looking at around about 1,000 loans there. So with a relatively small average loan size, and we have a cap on our maximum loans loan size there, so that you're looking at around about that range between 700 and 1,000 per transaction.
Fantastic. So securitized assets like corporate bonds are rated. So the tranches are rated. But how do they differ between corporate bonds for a similarly rated tranche, say a BBB tranche, between a corporate bond and a securitized investment?
So the RMBS and CMBS and ABS are typically structured as a bankruptcy remote vehicle. So the structures will continue to function if the lender becomes insolvent, as a result, these transactions provide investors protection against a single name risk, which might occur in a corporate bond, where the risk is directly tied to the entity and whether that entity defaults or not. In ABS transactions, the bonds are secured over the mortgages. In this case, the RMBS and CMBS, it's real property. So it's secured by a pool of existing commercial and residential assets, which in the worst case, we can take mortgagee in possession and sell those real assets. In a corporate bond, your security is over the corporate assets. So it depends, obviously, depending on the quality of the corporate, the value of those assets can be variable. And that's not too dissimilar within property. We've all experienced quality, the difference between a quality property and a subpar property. So the underlying value and quality of those assets is really important. But within ABS transactions, specifically RMBS and CMBS, they are existing property assets that they're secured by. Traditional corporate bonds generally pay interest over the life of the bond and pay the maturity pay the principal on maturity. RMBS is amortizing in nature, which means it's repaying interest and principal over the life of the transaction, which does start to reduce some of the default risk on the principal side of things for investors.
So risk is actually declining as the investment ages, if you like.
It does. Again, it's on the loans that are performing as a principal is being paid down. If you have a pool percentage of those loans who fall into trouble, that percentage is going to look a lot bigger at the end of the transaction because the quality loans have paid down the principal, so the remaining principal will have a higher proportion of non-performing loans in there. But you are having principal paid down throughout the life of the loan as well, as we said, it just helps decrease that default risk a little bit for investors.
So I guess, Lauren, if they're paying down the loan, assuming the market's stable, they're de-risking as well because the percentage of equity is increasing.
Yep.
So
it kind of goes both ways.
Exactly right. So is there a difference in yield between asset-backed securities and corporate bonds of similar ranking? And if so, can you explain why?
Absolutely. So with many investors, the primary difference in the yield is the risk and versus the return. Mortgage funds are an illiquid product, and as such, investors receive that illiquidity premium for locking their money up for a period of time. And it's not just locking the money up, it's if everybody wants their money all at once, as we've seen through certain economic cycles, there are certain assets that takes longer to get money back than others. Yes, you might be taking a haircut for those liquid assets. So because you don't have that liquidity option with a mortgage fund and with a pool of mortgages in that worst case scenario, investors receive that illiquidity premium. Generally the underlying risk of a CMBS and RMBS transaction is a little higher than, say, a government bond. I appreciate we're talking about a corporate bond here, but even a top tier corporate bond. So investors are receiving a risk premium for taking on that extra risk and thus the higher yields. In securitization programs, there is an opportunity to invest in different tranches of the transaction, which has a different level of risk and return depending on the investor's preference. So the senior tranche of the RMBS and CMBS transactions typically price at tighter margins compared to a corporate bond of relatively equal standing. And as the degree of subordination increases through the different tranches, so does the margin. So as you go down the debt stack, your return increases because there's less subordination underneath you. And there's different tranches for different investor preferences.
I should say too, or should make a comment, that often the top tranche is AAA rated, so it is the rated the same as the government debt, but it's often paid off very quickly because it's the first to have principal applied to it. So its terms can be quite short, can't they?
Yes, and in our experience, those transactions are snapped up by domestic financial institutions. And some of the big banks. So for private investors, it's going to be very difficult, if not near impossible, to get access to that tranche because it's just not available to retail investors, even through a pooled fund, even through a broker. Generally, the top couple of tranches are very institutional dominant, and then from the middle, subordinated tranches and down is where you start to see private investors and credit funds and brokers and aggregators of bond products getting involved. And part of that's also the risk return profile, because of what their private clients are looking for. That's where the yield is, but also where there's not as much competition with the large institutional banks who generally take the top tier tranches.
Now, as we're talking, Lauren, one of the things I realise that we should talk about a little bit is credit ratings, and the credit rating agencies are quite involved in the ABS market, aren't they?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So they actually analyse the data and assign credit ratings and require minimum amounts of subordination below different tranches, don't they?
Our tranches get rated by S&P and more recently Fitch. So there's many institutional investors out in the market who can actually only, their mandates only allow them to access these transactions through the rated programs. So we have a lot of institutional investors who work with us on those rated programs, which we issue a couple of times a year. And because of those ratings and the research that S&P and Fitch provide, not just on the loan book, but on Think Tank as a business, and that there's a lot of due diligence that goes, it's not purely on the loan book. There are a few other metrics that they look at as well. And we're able to use those ratings and sort of shadow them across to our debt warehouse, which is where we get institutional funding in sort of perpetuity as we're filling up the writing the loans and filling up the warehouses. So we have a rough idea of the quality of the loans that we're originating and where they're going to fit in the rated structure, so that we can maintain those relationships with the institutional investors who require certain ratings and a certain quantum of funds, you know, per tranche, to suit their mandates.
So a couple of things there. You talked about warehouses. It literally is a place where mortgages are pooled and they're waiting for the enough of the 700 or the 1,000 or however many are going to go into the pool to complete before it's sold to the market. So I just wanted to clarify that. But the credit rating agencies play a really important part, and I guess part of what they're looking at as well with Think Tank, it's been many years since you've been in the market and you have built up that relationship with your investors, but also with the credit rating agencies. So they understand management and what you do. And do they give you, I imagine they give you credit for that.
I would think so. We did our first private placement in 2014, I believe, and our first securitization CMBS in 2015. And then we opened up the RMBS programs a few years later, once our residential lending really took off. S&P has been doing most of our ratings, and then Fitch started also rating the transactions a few years ago. It was either just before COVID or during COVID. But the continuity of the business is very important, as much as the loan book is. And going back to a point I said earlier, because these transactions do have a bankruptcy remote vehicle, you are, and it's a trust structure. If something did happen to the business, then the loans would continue on, the trust would continue on. There would just be no further origination. So there might be a slightly different style of due diligence when it comes to looking at the business continuity, as opposed to, say, a corporate bond, where you really are relying on the fact that the going concern of the business is going to be there in 3, 4, 5, 10 years. Whereas our underlying pool of mortgages and the credit underwriting and our credit procedures, our collection procedures, and the assets that we take and the borrowers that we borrow to and the LVRs that we lend to, the location, that's really what you're looking at. Because at the end of the day, if you're left with a pool of mortgages that you're trying to collect on, if something was to happen to the business that issued, that trust will continue to operate. The bankruptcy remote vehicle will step in, and those loans need to be collected on. So the rating agencies will be looking at slightly different things when comparing the two style of bonds, but the underlying business continuity is very important, and the quality of the management and all that comes with that is a big part of their research and their ratings.
Now that we've got a bit of a feel for ABS, CMBS and RMBS, perhaps can you describe the Australian market for people? Because it's quite a lot larger than people realise, and your expectations for the coming year?
Yeah, absolutely. So this information, I'll just be throwing out a few numbers here. This has come from a report that Westpac produced called very creatively named Australian Securitisation 2023 Year in Review and 2024 Year Ahead. So in 2023, the securitisation market was $52.3 billion. It's billion with a B. And non-bank lenders make up 73% of those issuances. And the majority of those issuances, maybe 80 to 85, are RMBS. So that's sort of a bit of a look back at where we were. And regarding the year ahead, the market started the year strong at this early stage and really appears to be on track for a similar year as last year. The non-banks that do operate in the debt capital markets operate quite heavily in the debt capital markets, and the growth in the non-bank space is correlated very much to the growth in securitization. And it's an investment structure that many institutional investors, global and domestic, they like because of the diversification, the rating, and the quality of the underlying assets. And for global investors, it's their way of obtaining exposure to the Australian market through a structured facility with issuers that have got a long track record. They can pick and choose their issuers. They've got the ratings behind them because they're generally, they might not be as experienced with Australia as our domestic institutions are. It's a really favourable way for those global investors to get exposure to Australia.
So, Lauren, it's really important with this asset class, it's really important to the functioning of Australia's financial economy, so much so that the government has stepped in to support it. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. During COVID in 2020, when the banks, many of the banks put, I believe all the banks did actually, they offered holidays or hardship to those borrowers that wanted to sort of put their mortgages on and loans on hardship. The non-banks we had the same arrangement. Any of our borrowers who required hardship for 3 months, bang, they got it right away. Now that meant that for a period of time there was an X percent of the portfolio that wasn't receiving any income. And because we raise all of our funding from investment, both institutional and direct private high net wealth investment, we have obligations to our investors to pay them a certain amount of interest every month as per the agreement. So by not having, say, 20% of the loan book paying interest for those few months because of that hardship, the government through the AOFM, the Australian Office of Financial Management, they basically stepped in and said, non-banks, you can borrow from us at the cash rate, which was 0.1% at the time, you can borrow from us the income that you're not receiving from your borrowers because of the COVID hardship. So that's a 20% of the book that was on hardship for 3 months. Think Tank borrowed that money from the government. And not just Think Tank, all non-banks would have done the same thing, borrowed that money. So we could still ensure that we were paying our investors, that there was no event of default from the investor's perspective. We didn't have to take any mortgagee in possession and sell assets and have any problems in the portfolio in that sense. So we were able to access that funding facility and that support facility, as were many of the non-banks. And Think Tank paid all that money back in October 2020 because it was really just that 6 months where we just weren't sure what was going to happen. So that's sort of at the loan level and at the warehouse level. At the securitization level, a big driver of success for most transactions is the tight pricing that you receive for the AAA tranches because they're the biggest tranches. So your overall cost of funds is essentially a weighted average cost of funds on what you're paying every single tranche. So if you've got a 750 mil transaction and 400 mil of it is sitting in that AAA, and normally that might be 1% over cash. If that cost of funds blows out to say 3% over cash, you're paying a lot more for a big, big tranche of that overall transaction. So your complete entire cost of funds for that deal, it widens to a point where it's almost unsustainable. So what the AOFM did, they stepped in and they said, we are going to bid for the top tranche and here's the price. And it was market price. If anybody wants it, you have to bid under me. So it's not a case of bidding overs. It's a case of if you want that, you have to bid less because as Think Tank, we're going to take the lower bid because we want to pay less for that transaction. So that was how the government support at that federal level stepped in and supported the non-banks, because if our cost of funds blew out, we wouldn't have been able to keep lending at the rates that we do. And we just would have run into all the non-banks would have run into some pretty serious liquidity problems there. So the government support at the borrower level to ensure that we can continue making all of our payments to our investors was crucial. And then as well at the securitization level, because without that liquidity, as we know, all the markets freeze up, and that's where you start to see asset prices declining quite rapidly because there's no liquidity in the market. So the government support wasn't just for Well, it wasn't just what we saw at a retail and at a consumer level and at a business level. It was also through the debt capital markets and through the non-banks, which got us through a pretty rough sort of 6 to 8 months. And then we were able to, the markets got a lot of confidence in 2021, as we all remember, once we got used to the new style of operating and off we went.
That's a great explanation, a really good explanation. And I just want to comment that, of course, all the major banks through the Term Funding Facility also had access to very cheap funds at that time and support as well. It wasn't just a non-bank lender, but I think what's so encouraging is it was across the board, and the government realised they wanted to keep people in their homes and their jobs through a very tough time. So really important to note that support, that government support. And while we're talking about government support, I think we should talk about the regulators, Lauren. Who regulates the ABS industry in Australia?
ASIC regulates these issuances, and ASIC regulates Think Tank. We've got our own AFSL. Now, this is an entirely wholesale market. So there is more onus on the individual investor to understand the market, which is generally why the investor that's actually buying the notes, they're an institution of some description. And many of those funds, they might be a credit fund or a bond, a broker or an aggregator of some description. Those funds generally have a sort of lean towards wholesale investors because the underlying asset is a little bit more complex, and because just the way that the market is, the transactions are quite large, you generally need to have larger transaction sizes to participate, and that generally falls into the wholesale market when you're looking at private investors. So ASIC regulates us, and it is a wholesale dominated market.
Okay, so Think Tank's issued nearly $10 billion since it started back in 2006. What sort of changes have you seen in the market over that time?
Yeah, so we've issued over $10 billion in loans since 2006. So we started pre-GFC, which was a fun time, I've been told, to start a new financial institution. So how's the market changed? Look, the pool of investors has become more global. Our initial issuances were predominantly entirely Australian investors, so it was a bit like we were playing cricket or rugby for New South Wales, and then we started to gain some exposure in the global market, and we were playing for Australia. So we were getting some interest from Asian, Japanese, European, the UK, and US alongside the traditional Australian investors. So as I said before, there is a lot of interest from global investors to gain access to the Australian market, especially in the property space. And the quantum of securitizations that are available out there allows quite a wide and diverse group of international investors gaining exposure to Australia, which is great because it means that we've got a much broader pool of funding and of investors to market to and to help grow not just our business but the entire sector.
Our diversity of funding is always a big tick for me.
Diversification. I'm just going to get it tattooed on my forehead. Diversification.
Diversification, exactly. I wanted to dig down into your last issue, your last asset-backed securities issue. Can you describe the loan pool and when did you do it? When was the last issue you had, and describe the loan pool for us?
Sure thing. So our last transaction settled in October last year. It was a 750 mil RMBS, a residential mortgage-backed transaction consisting of 137 standard residential loans, predominantly to self-employed borrowers. Average loan size was 732,000 and average weighted LVR was 70, just under 70%. And that transaction was upsized from 500 mil. So we initially launched at 500 mil and we received a large amount of bids, and we were able to upsize that to 750.
So can you just remind us what LVR is?
Sure. The LVR is the loan-to-value ratio. So the borrowers borrowed a property at $1 million. They borrow $700,000 from Think Tank, and they've got $300,000 worth of borrowers' equity in that property.
So what type of investors bought into that RMBS? Obviously, it was oversubscribed and you increased, which is really positive, a big tick to the company. But can you describe what investors, they were global, I presume?
So we've got the domestic and global institutional investors, which includes banks and fund managers and super funds.
And how many tranches were there, and was there a tranche that received the greatest demand? Was it the AAA tranche?
So we had eight tranches, and they were all well supported. As I said, the transaction was started at 500 mil and was upsized based on demand. There's demand all across the tranches. The top tranches do generally get quite a lot of oversubscription, but all of the tranches were oversubscribed. I think it would be quite difficult to upsize if you only had oversubscription or increased demand in one tranche, because you couldn't get the other tranche away. So there had to be oversubscription across the whole debt stack, because otherwise we wouldn't have been able to upsize the transaction with confidence that we'd be able to secure the required subordination in every tranche that we needed.
Okay, and often the lowest tranche is called the equity tranche, mm-hmm. and sometimes the issuing company own that equity tranche. Is that true? Do they always own it, or do they sometimes own it, or can you explain that a little bit, Lauren?
Yeah, since the GFC, the rules around owning the equity tranche have changed, which is probably a good thing given what unfolded. So Think Tank and related parties own the equity notes in all the transactions that we issue, so we've got skin in the game. And what that equity tranche essentially does for investors is it takes a first loss piece. So if all of the capital or the equity within the pool was exhausted, so we're seeing properties across the board being sold for 30% less than what they were originally mortgaged at, Think Tank's capital is at risk first across all those transactions.
But that gives, I think, investors a huge sense of confidence that when you're writing the loans, you're taking the time to do the research properly, and you don't want to write any loans that are going to incur losses, because they're going to hit you first. So
hit us first, yeah. And look, losses are part of lending. It's a balancing act, because if you have no arrears and no losses, then you're probably being a little bit too conservative and your growth is going to be stunted. If you have a pool that were all written at the same time, then you probably have got that all go into arrears at the same time. You probably got a bit of a problem with either how you were doing the assessment or the security that you took. But across the book, across the board, loans that go in and out of arrears, and there's no real determining factor or there's no real pattern, that's just part and parcel of lending. So it does give investors a lot of confidence that that Think Tank is confident and issuers are confident in their underwriting standards and their ability to collect if things go wrong, and their the equity per the amount of equity that we ask for the borrower to take on average in those small loan sizes, so that if something goes wrong as a one off, we can step in and do what needs to be done to reclaim that money. And if not, then if the scenario unfolds where we just weren't able to for whatever reason, the market, then there is protection there for investors. So again, I agree. I very much hope that it gives them confidence that we've got skin in the game for everything we write.
Now, the loans, of course, the residential mortgage-backed securities, this particular tranche, are issued all over Australia, aren't they, and in cities and regional cities. So there is, like, diversification in the pool. There's not 60% in Western Melbourne, for example, or, you know,
yeah.
25% in, you know, rural Queensland or whatever. So
they're very well diversified. They're predominantly East Coast, which probably won't come as a big surprise. And they are diversified across different borrower types, different businesses, different assets, different areas. So we're a lender that's based on geography. So there's certain areas that we can and can't lend to because of the population sizes. So our geography is very geared towards the population size. Spread all across the country, but as I said, predominantly on the East Coast. But we just opened up an office in WA, and we're seeing the WA market is growing, which is really exciting.
Congratulations. Just this last question about this particular loan pool. So when you bring a new RMBS to market, there's price guidance on the individual tranches. I'm just wondering, with oversubscription, were you then able to issue at the lower range in the tranche, or did you go even lower than that? How did that work for the yield on those tranches?
Yeah, so for this transaction, pricing in some tranches were tighter than the initial guidance, and others were in line. So you do see the pricing get tighter generally at the top, because there's a lot of demand, a lot of oversubscription, and those tighter prices assist the issuer with their costs of funds, because that's where the big bulk of the transaction is getting priced at. So it wasn't always like this. There are times over the last few years where we've seen dislocations. Interestingly enough, this time last year when we had those, the US had their challenges with a few of their banks and Switzerland and with Credit Suisse, the markets did expand a little bit. So there can be out of cycle widening and tightening depending on what's going on in the broader market, which can cause a bit of havoc for issuers. If obviously we don't know these things are going to happen, so you just somewhat hope that when you issue that you're not about to have something overseas that might impact your pricing. But if you've done this for a long, long time, you've got your investors that you work with, they know you, it hopefully will impact you less. But it is a risk when you go out to market that there might be something external and with completely out of your control and unpredictable happen that can widen those margins. But thankfully for us, with our transaction in October last year, we were able to get tighter pricing than was initially quoted.
I know that some issuers and corporate bond issuers will pull new issues if there's a big dislocation, which makes perfect sense to me. But
we see it in the residential property market. You put your property on the market, hey, maybe you get what you want, maybe you get more, maybe you don't. Okay, I'm not willing to take that hit or whatever the scenario is.
Exactly.
So it's not too dissimilar.
Exactly. You make a commercial decision at the time. But we note now that arrears are ticking up, particularly in some commercial property transactions and even residential loans. What's Think Tank's assessment of the market and expectation of your current RMBS loans in the market?
So let's, assuming they're at the rate cycle peak, and that really depends on who you ask, but let's for argument's sake say that we are either at the peak or very, very close, and unemployment rises hopefully modestly from here, which seems to be the case so far. We expect arrears to rise a little bit in the short term, but then sort of stabilise and decline. So we haven't seen a massive spike since rates started rising. It's been a relatively steady increase, which is probably the best we could have asked for, because if you see a big spike, then there could be a risk that the credit underwriting for a certain pool of the loans at a certain time was might have missed the mark, and given the level of rate rises that the borrowers, all of us, have absorbed so far, performance is definitely better than we were expecting, which I think seems to be the feedback across the entire industry and across many commentators, and which is probably giving the RBA a little bit of pause, because it's good that we were able to be resilient. But we don't want to be too resilient, because that might give them the desired impetus to go again. But that our pool of borrowers has been as resilient as many others, which has been a little bit of a surprise. And seasonal factors play a role with a peak around December, January. That's not just isolated to Think Tank. That happens across the board, and it happens every year. It's pretty consistent, and then we can pretty much predict that it's going to have a bit of a spike in those couple of months. So we're seeing the arrears in Feb declining from those seasonal peaks, which is again what generally happens as we start the year and people get back into the swing of things. And we've been doing this for a very long time. We're managing our arrears well, and thanks to our established arrears and collections procedures and the strong underwriting that underpins the loan book.
It's interesting. Everything I'm hearing as well is that the market's performed much better than expectation. It's been more resilient. People have had savings. They've taken extra jobs. I fully understand the seasonal peak, you know, from starting from that Black Friday shopping late November.
Yeah.
You know, crazy mad time into Christmas and holiday time, you know.
And from that, we saw retail numbers in December look really weak because all the spending was done in November. Because you can get the present you were going to get for XYZ in November for half the price, wouldn't you?
Exactly. Exactly.
Maybe right. One or two more for yourself. That generally happens. that girl math comes into play big time when there's sales.
Oh, yeah, that handbag you've been looking at. You know, can't resist it. So starting to wrap up now, but what are the principal characteristics of the leading non-bank lenders, and can you give us a sense of their scale?
Yeah, so I mentioned earlier that the size of the securitisation market in 2023 was 52.3 billion. The size of the entire non-bank lending market is higher than that, because not all banks can operate in the securitization market. There's quite a few, and it generally comes down to the asset that just can't be securitized. So you might be looking, I think the numbers from a couple of years ago was 65 billion. It's definitely higher than that now, as more and more borrowers look to alternative sources of lending, or they look to borrow through structures, which is generally where the non-banks really pick up a lot of business. And some of the characteristics of non-bank lenders are that that we're adaptable. We're fast to respond, but we take time to understand the customer. So there's nothing worse than taking 3 weeks to get to a no. If it's going to be a no, let's do a quick no. But I know that the way that our lending team work with our brokers and our aggregators is if it might be a no now, but let's try and workshop the deal with you so that we can help you either get to a yes or show you the path to get to a yes. So it's not a no and thanks for coming and see you later. It's very much a case of we want to work with you, so let's see what we can do here. It's very relationship driven, very, very relationship driven. And we are generally a little bit more nimble than some of the major banks.
Okay, so for the listeners today, Think Tank offer two direct products, if you like. Can you just talk us through the characteristics of those and maybe compare and contrast them a little so our listeners have a good idea of what's on offer?
Absolutely. So in 2017, Think Tank opened up the Income Trust and the High Yield Trust. These products are available to direct high net wealth and wholesale and sophisticated investors. The Income Trust is a direct first mortgage fund, so the mortgages are originated out of that trust, and investors in the Income Trust have exposure to that pool of specific loans. The current LVR is 75%, and the return on that product is 3.6% fixed plus the BBSW 30. That changes monthly because it's the bank bill swap rate for 30 days, and that gets reset every month. So right now the return is 7.9%, and it will most likely stay that way until we have the next RBA meeting. So obviously it used to change every month because we had them every month except for January. But now that we have the RBA meetings in a different structure, the BBSW 30 will still get reset every 30 days, but we just might see the cash rate change not in the first week of the month like we used to see. The High Yield Trust is a mortgage-backed securities fund, which invests in the second loss notes within our CMBS and RMBS programs. So you might recall earlier I was saying that Think Tank takes the first loss piece, equity piece, in all of our transactions. The High Yield Trust sits above Think Tank and invests in all of those RMBS and CMBS programs. So High Yield Trust sits above Think Tank and underneath all of our institutional investors. So it's exposed to the entire pool of mortgage-backed securities, as opposed to the Income Trust, which is directly exposed to the mortgages originated out of that fund. And the High Yield Trust returns 6.5% fixed over BBSW 30. So since inception in 2006, Think Tank's originated over $10 billion in loans and experienced $3.9 million of losses, which were all absorbed by excess spread. So that's essentially the income that is derived from the property after all investors are paid and after all of Think Tank's costs are absorbed from running the business. That's the excess spread there. So what that means is that no investor has either missed an interest payment or had a capital loss to date, and that's institutional and private. And the direct exposure to a diversified pool of mortgages versus exposure to the subordinated tranches in the RMBS transaction, that's really the difference between the Income Trust and the High Yield. One is direct exposure and one is through the notes. And the underlying assets are similar in the two funds. The High Yield Fund, High Yield Trust, provides exposure through those subordinated notes, through that second loss piece, as I was saying there. So Think Tank's Investment Trust, we don't have exposure to construction or development funding. And our total portfolio, as at the 29th of Feb this year, 2024, is $5.6 billion, which consists of over 9,000 loans. So investors are exposed to a diversified pool of mortgages and security properties across the whole portfolio. And as I said before, these trusts are available to high net worth, sophisticated or wholesale investors only. The minimum investment's $10,000. The minimum term is 12 months. and the returns are variable, so the loan products, and so are our loan products. So as the cash rate rises and falls, the mortgage rates respond accordingly. Think Tank obtains most of our funding from domestic and global institutions, many of whom we've been investing and working with for a long time, and the Income and High Yield Trust allow private investors to gain exposure to a part of the market that has traditionally been held by the institution. So hopefully the diversified pool of mortgages and our track record provides investors with a bit of comfort that we've done a good job, and it's an asset class that they're looking to generate some income from.
That is excellent, Lauren. We have covered a lot today, and I think our listeners really appreciate your comments and our frank discussion. Is there anything you'd like to add to finish up?
Thank you for having me and for going through all of that. I know we covered off a lot today. So if anyone is interested in learning a little bit more, our website's thinktank.net.au, or you can reach me, lryan@thinktank.net.au. I look after all the private investors and happy to answer any questions or any feedback or just talk through how it all works with anyone who's interested.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Lauren Ryan. We really appreciate it.
Thanks, Liz. Great to be here.
Thank you for joining us this week on Fixated, the Fixed Income Podcast. Still hungry for more fixed income news, views and education? Then visit fixedincomenews.com.au and don't forget to subscribe to our newsletter to have the latest news delivered right to your inbox. Thanks again for joining us. I'm Elizabeth Moran and we'll see you next episode on Fixated, the Fixed Income Podcast.